Welcome to the Daily Friend Show, offering insightful and thought-provoking news commentary and analysis from a classically liberal centrist perspective. The show is brought to you by the Institute of Race Relations. Tune in at 4:30 every Monday to Thursday for engaging discussions from our team of analysts and researchers that you won't find anywhere else.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and I'm joined today by Mr. Herman Pretorius. Herman, how are you doing?
I'm fine, thanks, and yourself, Nick?
I'm pretty good, thank you, pretty good. And we are, of course, joined today by Dr. France Crenier, our CEO. France, how are you doing?
I'm also doing well, Nick. Hello to you, hello to Herman.
Excellent. Now, let's get stuck into things. So last night, you, Herman, and some of our other colleagues, Anthea and Gabriel, had a lengthy discussion about what the medium-term budget policy statement actually means for people, for ordinary South Africans. But I thought on this show it might be a little bit, and you can check that out if you subscribe to us on one of the podcast platforms. However, I would ask if you could possibly go over some of that, what you said last night, maybe anything you might want to add to it. That we, of course, heard in the speech yesterday by Finance Minister Tito Mboweni, just updating the country on its finances, that there was some talk of cuts, there was some talk of fighting corruption. But France, what's the real story here? What should we take away when we think about the budget speech from yesterday?
I think the meaning of it is that it's now into the last stages of the end game for the South African government when it comes to its finances. And I'll tell you why that is. The most important number, I thought, in his speech was when he said, or certainly in the accompanying tables and charts, showed that this year the government's expenditure will equate to almost 42% of GDP. So of the size of the economy, what the government will spend will be equivalent to that. Now, this is an extraordinary figure. As a proportion of revenue will be will approximate 42%. It's an enormous amount. When Thabo Mbeki and Trevor Manuel ran South Africa's finances with some success, the figure was around 25%. And I think it even got down to 24 or so. So these chaps today are spending at a level 15 percentage points higher than was the case 15 years ago. And that's just by international standards an eye-watering number, and it's wholly unsustainable. It can't carry on for long before you get into a serious a position with your debt and your interest payments that you can no longer afford. And it's instructive if you want an insight, a window into the soul, as it were, of policymakers, because this level of expenditure suggests that the government believes that it can far more efficiently direct expenditure around the society than ordinary people or the private sector can. Now, against that very high level of expenditure, you must read the economic growth forecast. And the minister said that this year would be very bad. I think he's still optimistic. He said negative 7.8. We think near a negative 10. And the next year, things look a bit better. The economy grows at about 3%, according to the minister. We're also around there in our forecast. But don't mistake that 3% for a recovery. It's the low base effect of the huge contraction this year. So something, there's enormous contraction this year, and next year there won't be an enormous contraction. But off the base of the contraction, it looks like there's a strong recovery. In fact, it's an illusion. The minister suggested that then in 2022, growth would fall back to 1.7%. In 2023, it would fall back to 1.5%. So that's the ambition of the government, to grow the economy at 1.5% in 2023. This is its target. And it's pathetic because emerging markets should by then comfortably have returned to the growth rates they've been averaging for the past decade, which are nearer 5%, which means that the ambition of the South African government is to grow its economy at around 20% of the rate that its competitors will do. And then this is the ambition. Now, the ambition is also, I think, a little bit far-fetched here, because over the past decade, the Treasury's growth forecasts have been wrong, its three-year forecast, by a margin of around 50%. So if the Treasury said the economy will grow at 3%, it's actually grown at 1.5%, and this has been a pretty become quite a solid rule of thumb. So it's more, if that rule continues to apply, and I think it will, the likelihood is that over the next 3 years, within 2023, let's say that, South Africa's economy will probably be growing at somewhere between 0 and 1%, meaning that it could grow at just 10% of the average of emerging markets. So an economy that's going to grow this slowly, where its state is spending such an eye-watering amount of money, is going to run out of money. And then I'll stop for you, then a few things can happen. One, they can get a big fright and become sensible and pragmatic and introduce policy reforms and abandon expropriation and attract investment and stop persecuting entrepreneurs in the middle classes and drop BEE and all of that. And the economy can grow strongly and South Africa can get out of trouble. So that's their first option. Their second option would be to say, well, they're not going to do reform, so let's go and borrow from the International Monetary Fund or something. But they're unlikely to do that because they don't want to surrender control of policy making to an external, particularly Western institution. Because any external financing institution, given the track record of the government, would attach some pretty firm conditions to such a bailout. So they're not going to grow the economy through reform, and they're not going to borrow from an external institution. Then what options are left for them? The only short-term, the most attractive short-term option, is to take things that belong to other people and apply them to plug spending gaps in the government itself. So, for example, you could have some broad form of prescribed assets where you compel pension funds to invest in government projects or bonds, and the consequence of that would be that you use their money to live on borrowed time for a little while. Once you've done that, though, you do great damage to the economy and the stock market as a consequence. There might be relatively little left to take within a few years, and then you could go and print money and see if that gets you anywhere. Now, there is a little toehold that's developed for practitioners of something that's called New Age Monetary Theory. And it's I called it earlier today in briefing about sorcery. And it holds that you can, as long as you borrow in your own currency, in other words, print lots of money, you can never go bankrupt because you just print some more. And I'm alarmed, afraid to tell you that this idea has got some traction now, even in the union buildings. And if people say to me, well, that's all too nuts, they'll never do that, other than the fact that governments around the world who got into trouble and wouldn't reform did exactly that. I'll say to that person, well, what's left? Because the only thing that's left is to accept that they will have to stop spending, cut spending, collapse the cadre deployment and procurement networks upon which the sort of that greases the wheels that maintain the internal unity of the ruling alliance. So it's a long answer for you, but it's an important answer, and it's what I said in my opening comments. The budget showed that the end game is here, very close, for the South African government in terms of running out of the finances it needs to maintain its political control of the country.
All right, so Herman, I've got two questions for you. Let me start with the first one, which is, do you have any response to what Franz said? Anything to add? Anything that people you think should think about?
Well, I think what Anthea Jeffrey said last night is something very, very important to also take into consideration when seeking to understand what France is saying. Is this is all part and parcel of the ideological direction that the SACP-ANC alliance has been on for decades. So if someone is going to say no, they will never do that because, you know, it just doesn't make sense. The problem is that you are assuming that policy decisions or policy directions are based on sense. They are based on ideology. And if you really want to understand what the ANC is busy with ideologically, then I think the works of people like Anthea really can illustrate how the National Democratic Revolution, a Leninist project to take a free or relatively free market and take it to socialism all the way through to communism, how it works and how what we are seeing in the antagonism to actual prosperity and actual success is, you know, that's part of the game for them. That's the rules they play by.
Indeed. And let me ask you the second question. And this is a little bit of a tangent, but one I think that's kind of something to think about with regards to the finance minister. So yesterday, the finance minister sort of went off on a bit of a tangent during the speech. He said, by the way, this Tygerberg hospital thing, it still has a black and white section. There's a section where blacks used to go and there's a section where whites used to go. Structurally, it is still there. So the thing has to be removed and a completely new hospital constructed there. It's unbelievable. The DA was very upset by the insinuation that a Western Cape hospital was racially segregated, and they responded very aggressively. And then in a Twitter exchange after the budget speech, Mboweni said to the Western Cape Minister for Health, please do not overreact. There are still two structures there, Tygerberg Hospital, one for blacks and the other for whites. They exist. What does not exist any longer is segregation of patients. That is the reality. You may not like it. So this is a very weird little thing for the finance minister to add into a speech, Herman. What do you think he was trying to do when he said this?
Oh, I think behind this there might not have been too much thinking, strategy or tactics. I think it's just a cheap political point to score. And I think Minister Mboweni knew that it wouldn't be taken well. And of course, it's convenient to try and sneak in the argument that the Democratic Alliance is somehow, you know, the inheritor or the heir of apartheid, when actually people should remember that the National Party died in the loving arms of the African National Congress around the year 2005.
Franz, any quick thoughts on this before we move on?
No, I don't. Never been to Tygerberg Hospital, and I've. But I mean, a lot of that speech, Nick. I mean, this is a particularly odd part of it. But the whole business was odd, you know. Even the sort of economics of it was odd. The whole thing was just, you know, bizarre, and it's taken seriously. It's amazing. It's the sort of cognitive dissonance that the chap announces, the minister, you know, that the government's going to spend 40% of GDP. I mean, it's almost half the economy. It's going to spend. It's got to borrow 15% of GDP just to make that possible. I mean, it's just as bizarre as his comments on Tygerberg Hospital, but also bizarre. Another one. While we're on it. It's a strange phenomenon. You see it in South Africa's cabinet. The minister at a moment in his speech stopped and said something along the lines that it's very important that we have policy certainty in South Africa. We need that. And he then told the story about an avocado tree, being an avocado farmer himself, that it takes apparently 7 years after planting the tree to get your first harvest, and if farmers don't have any certainty, none will invest. So there needs to be certainty to invest. And that's all right, of course. We all say, yes, that's right. But that was it. Okay. And then that... without the appreciation that he is the Minister of Finance. If there is a more influential role in the government when it comes to formulating policy, I don't know what it is. So to hear the man who is so influential in formulating policy telling the public that policy is so uncertain, but not taking the next step, which should have started, and therefore we will be abandoning all this EWC stuff, but rather going on with, you know, the next paragraph of his speech, was also odd. It was an odd speech. Nick, back to you.
Yes, I think the great casualty of this budget speech, and possibly some of the previous ones as well, is that the credibility of the ANC's finance ministers, which used to be quite high, especially, of course, during the Mbeki years, is rapidly eroding. Anyway, let us move on to our next topic for today, and that is this weekend the DA is going to be electing some senior leaders for the party. So the one that's caught the most attention is the battle between interim leader John Steenhuisen to try and retain leadership of the party against challenger Mbali Ntuli. And then also there's a contest for the federal chairperson of the party, which is currently held by Helen Ziller, and she's fending off a challenge from Mike Moriarty, who used to be the chairperson of the DA in Gauteng. So let's start with the leadership race. We've seen this very interesting phenomena where Steenhuisen hasn't been seen that much to be campaigning in the media, but Mbali has been very well covered in a lot of the media. She's had columns written about how she should be the next leader of the party. She did an interview with a comedian who I'm not particularly fond of, Coconut Kales, or Kales. And she's taken quite a critical line of the party. She suggested that the DA is all about enforcing the status quo, that it's currently got an insider-outsider cliques who are controlling the organization, and that only by appointing a young black woman to lead it will they be able to properly grow. So, Franz, let me start with you. What do you make of this leadership race? Who do you think is going to win, and what do you think the new leader should do?
I've always really been so distant from the DA and its leadership dramas that I really couldn't say. Armand might be better informed. But what I will say broadly is that sort of like cheap political stuff that, you know, if you don't, I don't know what Ms. Ntuli has said, but I take it from you that, you know, if you don't have a black leader, you can't grow. I mean, there's no basis for that. In fact, the evidence in South Africa shows that those kind of lazy racial tropes don't really exist. I mean, the DA suffered its only defeat under a black leader, probably because it relied on the fact that he was black to grow more than it relied on the quality of the ideas and the arguments that that party put forward. And I will tell you one thing, that into next year, we've got polls out in the field now. I'll report them on your program, Nick, if you invite me, as soon as they're back. From the field that's polling where the politics stands. But I'll tell you one thing. I think that following the upheavals of recent years in the DA, my expectation is you'll see that party recover into 2021 and probably grow fairly strongly into 2024.
So just to clarify on what Ntuli herself has said about race, I can't remember her exact words on it, but a lot of her supporters have explicitly made this argument, particularly in the media. Herman, over to you. Same questions I just asked Franz. What do you make of this race, and what do you think, who do you think is going to win, and what should the new leader do?
I think the race is definitely John Steenhuisen's to lose. So I would be very surprised if that kind of envisioning from our side doesn't play out. So and I think the same with other more senior positions. Of course, our former colleague Helen Ziller also likely also alongside along with what we imagine happening from the Institute of Race Relations side, likely to retain her position. And I think that those are positive developments, and And I think the Institute can really be proud of the fact that for the last 10 years, it has been very much active in reforming liberal thought, not just, you know, in general, but having specific interest in making sure that our, as it were, political party cousin, the Democratic Alliance, can find some form of internal liberalism there. And I hope we see that, you know, that project playing out quite successfully over this weekend. And all in the service, of course, of the liberty and the importance of individual liberty in South Africa. And, you know, taking that argument further to say that, you know, the liberty of the South Africans is something worth fighting for. So I think the Mbalin Thuli has, I think she really doesn't have much of a chance. And I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. But the uncomfortability I feel with her attempt to become leader in her campaign is the fact that it really has this hint of Maimaniism to it, that you can be slightly non-racial. Non-racialism is like, you know, pregnant or dead. You either are it or you're not. There isn't a shade of non-racialism. And as long as you inject this narrative, this rhetoric that the color of someone's skin should matter in whether they can serve their country as leader of the official opposition in parliament, the moment you start entertaining those things, I think you are very, very much repeating the mistakes that saw the failure of Musi Maimane's leadership manifest so dramatically about a year ago. And my sister actually asked me a very interesting question. What should the DA have done with Mbalin Thuli? You know, because there has been this awkwardness surrounding public debates and so on. And as a general rule, I think we liberals, we people who believe firmly in liberty, should believe enough in liberty to especially promote the battle of ideas and not to shy away from it. I think it was a mistake for the party not to have a public debate. And I can understand why they did it. You know, they didn't want Mbalin Thuli to be able to pander to the more racialized elements of the South African commentariat. But what I genuinely hope the DA will at some stage learn is that it matters far more what the people of South Africa think of you than what the media or the commentariat think of you. Polls have consistently shown there to be a moderate, sensible, decent middle, people who don't care whether a doctor, a policeman, a teacher is black, white, colored, Indian, as long as that person is, you know, good at what they're supposed to do. And I think that's a compelling argument. And to me, it's a bit disappointing that at least the perception has been created that there couldn't be a public debate between the two leadership candidates because the one might play the race card to the detriment of the party's image as a whole. And then I think the sadness there is that if that is the case, then that means the candidate on the other side of the debate stage likely couldn't then call out the nonsense of racialism. So that's the tiny, you know, bit of disappointment I feel about how the DA has handled the process. But I'm quite comfortable and certain that this weekend we will see developments in the elections of these important positions that will not be displeasing to the friends of the IRR.
Indeed. The other important thing to look at will be resolutions adopted on the Congress floor. So while these don't always get taken perhaps as seriously as they should by the party, they do give a strong indication of where the kind of ideological direction of the party is. So there'll be a whole range of those. Some will probably be a bit mad. Some will probably be fantastic. But if any of the, you know, we'll have to see which of those emerge victorious after the DA's party Congress. Anyway, let's move on now to our last story for today, which is one that France is very fond of and eager to talk about. And that is a storm has enveloped one of South Africa's top netball tournaments, the Telkom Netball League. This comes after a team called the Mpumalanga Sunbirds were forced to forfeit their match against another team called the Kingdom Queens in the first Division B semifinal, which they initially won by 43-42 points. They were forced to forfeit because they were fielded too many black players during the second quarter of their match, and as a result were deemed to have lost the match 42-0 because that quarter of the match didn't count for them. The rules say teams are forbidden for fielding a team with less than four black players on the court at any given time, but can also be punished for fielding too few white players, which is with at least two required to be on the court. France, what should we make of this?
I think it's a great story. And you've got to get your head around it a little bit. But it goes something like this. What's happened in netball is that the team that won lost because it fielded too many black players in South Africa. Under the rules set out by the country's empowerment policies to make up for the exclusion of black people from playing competitive sport during apartheid. And that's, I got it right, actually. And I think it's a great thing. It's, well, what it might mean, it's an odd milestone, but it might mean that race-based policy in South Africa has finally hit its zenith, its ultimate point, where the absurdities are, see what happened here. And I think it's a good story to get out because I think it demonstrates, better than anything else can, what the end game for this kind of policy in the country is. And now it's high time that we forget about all this nonsense obsession with race. And when it comes to empowerment, the purpose is to give opportunities to people who never had them before. And you do that by determining whether a person is poor and disadvantaged, not using a proxy such as an accident of birth.
Of course, agree completely. Herman, do you have anything to add to that point?
Yeah, actually, it reminds me of something that France actually said earlier in the year in a policy meeting, when he said that, you know, if we become involved in the Institute of Race on a specific issue where we, through that legal action, essentially force the court to say racial discrimination against white people in South Africa is, of course, how things should be. It is right and proper and good. Now, I think one of the things that I've learned in my, you know, year and a bit at the Institute is to really look longer term for victories and defeats. In the short term, such a court judgment or such a confirmation of, I hesitate to use the phrase institutional racism, but such a confirmation would, in the short term, feel like a tremendous defeat and an insult to millions of people in this country. And that's right. In the short term, it probably should be seen as that. But in the slightly, you know, longer term, in the medium term, if you take a step backward and you use a wider lens to see, you identify that this is, as France says, perhaps, you know, an inflection point, perhaps the zenith of stupidity. Things must often become as stupid as they possibly can be before they are accepted to be stupid and climate of opinion starts shifting against that. And I think we saw it with during apartheid, certainly from the Institute's point of view. But from a legal point of view, I think of the Harris cases where the constitutional parameters of apartheid was just pushed to such a point where it had to be made constitutionally, legally, judicially clear how mad this whole system was. So when South Africans see the manifestation of insanity in this, they shouldn't go, oh my goodness, there they go. Shouldn't throw their hands up in the air. They should say, good, the idiots are exposing themselves. We can start shifting the climate of opinion, because now it is clear for all to see that the court jester doesn't have any clothes on.
Yes, indeed. And I think that one of the features of 2020 across the world, but especially in South Africa, has been just when you think it can't get any stupider, it does. Anyway, with that note, we are going to call it to a close for today. Thank you very much for listening. Please become a friend of the Institute of Race Relations. Go to our website, irr.org.za. Click the Join Us button. Give us your details, and we'll call you back to sign you up as a friend of the IRR. Thanks very much for listening, and we'll see you next week on The Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone.